On this week's episode of the Ortho Podcast, we have recurring guest Midhat Patel, fourth year resident, current fellowship applicant. We were planning to really just catch up, given the fact that we had taken about 8 months off, and we do address that. Life kind of hit us fast and board collections came, but here we are. We're calling it season two, but it's really just the same thing, an extension of season one, if you want to call it that. But Midhat Patel, talk about fellowship, kind of a deep dive into his process and why we do fellowships in the first place. Good talk. Hope you guys enjoy it. If you do enjoy it, leave us 5 stars on whatever platform you're listening on. If you don't, tell us why at OrthoTalkPod on Twitter or at our email, theorthopodcast@gmail.com. Catch any of our other episodes at our website, OrthoTalkPod.com. Hope you guys enjoy the episode. Without further ado, Dr. Midhat Patel.
Hey, can we time out? All right. All good dudes, stop what you're doing. This is time out. This is the OrthoTalk Podcast. Today we are doing a real conversation with an illustrious guest. Surgeons today are Asif Khalid and Jay Chen. Antibiotics, ANSEF, of course, what do we even ask? Fire risk, high due to lit conversations and explosive topics. Any questions or concerns? Nope. All right, we can go. Incision.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to season two. Is what we're calling it now, season two of the Ortho Talk Podcast. Jay, who you might remember from before, got a haircut and has started boxing. Midhat Patel, who is what, a fourth year?
Fourth year.
Fourth year resident somewhere in Arizona, is back, recurring guest, Midhat Patel. How's it going?
How's it going, Midhat?
So good.
Wait. Why don't we take such a long hiatus? What happened?
You know, I became a fourth year. I had a lot of work to do. Also, I'm not relevant for that. So.
So Jay, what has happened in the like six? Well, how long has it been? Did anyone calculate this? Did we come prepared for this meeting?
Wildly unprepared.
Maybe like a year? Has it been a year?
Close to a year. I think
July. I got it here. July 17th is our last podcast. So
3 months.
Yeah, 8-9 months. So in that time, we've started and finished board collections.
Yep. That's probably why we stopped, because of board collections.
Yeah, that got kind of hectic for a while.
Things got busy, and we decided to lay low for board collections. And I had another kid.
You had another kid.
Yeah, so my new kid is 4 months old.
I got a Peloton.
Ooh.
I stopped using my Peloton all within 8 months.
Yeah.
I love the Peloton.
All right. Well, Midhat, tell me, so you're a fourth year now. You're doing fellowship applications. How's that going?
Yeah, interviews now. It's good. It's the shoulder, I think, is a little bit different than the other specialties, because I think the other specialties are a bigger world. Shoulder is quite small, so everyone knows everyone. It's sort of the same people that are at every interview. The programs are so few that they are all good. I've yet to interview someone and be like, man, this place is so bad, or I don't want to come here. You know, they're all very good. So,
what was the goodest one?
Oh, I can't say that. That's not allowed. The ASCS would get mad at me.
Are they virtual interviews, or are you doing in-person stuff?
They're all virtual, which I absolutely hate. I guess it's easier financially and logistically in a sense, although the trauma service still doesn't make it easy logistically. But yeah, I just feel like two major issues. One, you can apply to all the programs, interview at all of them versus having to choose, which would cut down the number of people at every interview. And then two is sort of that you really don't get a sense for where you are or what the attitude is like or what the environment is like through a virtual interview.
How do you tell, like, what are you looking for when you're ranking fellowships?
Wait, hold on. I want to change that question a little bit. If you could design like your ideal fellowship, what would that be?
You guys are killing me. What if someone listens to this and then they're
9 o'clock in the morning? Come on.
It's episode one of season two. No one's gonna listen to this.
We only have the hard hitting questions here, man. And we're rusty, so we gotta get this thing going.
You can go on another podcast if you want the softballs.
So, I mean, I think the baseline of anything is helping develop good technical skills. Like all the other things, leadership or mentoring or research or whatever they have, is all sort of secondary to being a good surgeon. If you're not a good surgeon, none of that is relevant. So I think first you have to have a good enough.
Yeah, but that's such a vague answer. How do you do that?
Yeah, so I'm getting there.
All right, fine. I'm hard hitting today.
I mean, I think the best way to do it is a balance of being left alone, or given the opportunity to do something without someone taking it from you, and then alternating that with someone showing you the way that they do it. So, for example, two of the fellowship programs that I interviewed at in the last week have independent fellow cases with attending. The fellows are credentialed as attendings, and they're doing their cases separately, like once a week or once every other week. And they love doing that because you have the chance to struggle or sort of learn or reflect through certain steps. And then the next week you go back with your attending and do the same cases and see how they do that step. And then you can go back and, you know, implement that or not implement that or try it. So I think that is really helpful in developing your technical skills. I don't like the idea of a place where someone takes it from you and keeps it, or someone doesn't ever give it to you, if that makes sense. So I think that's important. And have a balance of able to do stuff on your own and push through steps, but then so that you know where you need to get better, basically, or what you haven't thought about yet that you need to think about.
How does that work? Like you're the attending on the case, but you're not doing the follow-up, you're not signing them up. You are? So you have your own clinic and everything too?
Most of the shoulder fellowships are not ACGME accredited fellowships. So you're credentialed as an attending everywhere you go. I mean, we finished residency, right?
We were too, but that was more for billing purposes. Like for sports, there were some cases that you could bill as a co-surgeon if they weren't in the ACGME core competencies, whatever it was for the fellowship. So for shoulder replacement, right? That wasn't a part of the sports curriculum or whatever. So we could bill as a co-surgeon, but that's why we did it. But it also let us time out on our own and that kind of stuff. So we didn't have to wait for the attending to start the case. Our model was a little different. We didn't really have independent cases. We had more of attendings were running two rooms and you ran your room or whatever case you were doing until they were done and ready. And then they would come in and finish up. So it gave us some autonomy and it also made us learn how to be efficient because you would want to do as much as you can before they got there.
Would you say ACGME accreditation is a net negative?
No, I don't think so.
No, really?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this isn't relevant for shoulder, but or for anywhere that I've interviewed, but I think it introduces some quote unquote protections. For residency, obviously the work hour restrictions or feeling like you don't have appropriate support outside of or within the hospital structure or the program structure if you have difficulties or challenges or whatever. I think the ACGME is the most important sort of hurdle for a program to or boundary for a program to stay within. That is not a reflection of our program. We always do. We're all very happy, but we got a Peloton and a rowing machine in our hospital gym. So we're all very mentally and physically fit people, you know? Yeah, I think that could be something that could be helpful. Again, I haven't done fellowships. I can't. None of the places I've gone or interviewed at has that ever even been remotely close to being an issue. I think only two of the shoulder fellowships are ACGME accredited anyways, out of 20 or 25. So,
yeah, foot was pretty similar. Most of them were not ACGME accredited. The one I went to was one of the few that was. And I don't think it took away from anything because just like most fellowship, oftentimes they would just run two rooms and the attending could time out and we'd still be pretty much independent for certain cases and certain attendings. I don't know.
I don't mean to make it sound like it's an unsafe thing because it's obviously not an unsafe thing. Even your own clinic in your own cases, the attending is either in the next room or readily available, or you're booking them in the attending's room to follow. So they're your patients, but you have their attending's immediate assistance if you need it.
What else do you look for? I mean, so your ideal fellowship, you say you want something where you're hands-on and you have autonomy and that, you know, what else?
Yeah, so I think there's a few things, but the next thing I think for me is sort of having a couple of mentors or people that can help help learn or help shape how you think about things. So shoulder more than other fields is a relatively younger field, but in general, like our attendings now that have been in practice for 20 or 30 years are doing cases that didn't exist when they were residents. And so we've done a training where we learn how to do these cases, but some of them will not exist when we're 20 years from now, you know? So I think it's really important to learn how to think about and approach new technologies and new techniques and new things so that when they are being thrown in your face or when they're happening or when you're addressing these problems that you know how to think about them safely. My example that I've given all my fellowship interviews is that McKee always says he never fixed a clavicle in residency, but you know, he's the one who did the studies to show that, hey, maybe we should fix clavicle. So I think it's important to learn how to safely think about problems that may not have great solutions at this point.
So what else?
Does that mean a fellowship that teaches you how to like do research is important, or is that
not necessarily to do research, but how to think about research or how to understand research or how to qualify research? I mean, we all know that, you know, just because a study gets published doesn't mean anything, quite frankly. I mean, there's a lot to try to sort out or decide, even though the popular literature loves to pick up on certain studies and run with them. The popular literature doesn't understand those nuances, whereas we do, right? So like a simple thing like an exclusion criteria could make a study not make sense, but CNN doesn't care. CNN just sees some great headline that patients are going to pick up on. I think there was one making the rounds on Twitter a few months ago about how you don't need knee replacements anymore because you can regrow cartilage in your knee with MACI or something. Yeah, and literally like the headline was like, this new technology will make knee replacements obsolete. And the arthroplasty guys are like, whoa, timeout. Like, that's obvious, you know what I mean? But that's what the headline was on like Forbes or something. So obviously that's something that's dangerous or scary. So I think you don't want surgeons drinking that Kool-Aid. And I think part of the importance is to sort of get that perspective and fellowship. And then
What about this concept of work-life balance that people are all about in residency? Is that a consideration of fellowship or?
Yeah, so that was going to be the last thing I said is sort of bundled into one jumble, but like a good work environment / work-life balance / sort of positive. I say work environment, but like the job is hard. There's going to be days that are crappy. For example, on one day in this last several months of my residency that I won't identify by any way whatsoever, we were doing a case or a surgery on a patient that took a long time, longer than I've ever done any case. 9 hours, we were there till midnight, futzing around. And the team that I was with, my attending, my junior resident, and the fellow, was the best team I could imagine having to do that case with. So, you know, even though it was long and miserable and difficult and we were all worn out and exhausted, we had a good enough time that we didn't want to blow our brains up. We're having a good time because it was us together. And so I think the positive work environment can really help overcome the objectively crappy things that might come up or might happen. And so I really value that because I think it helps you get through those difficult times, which are sort of inevitable. And then work-life balance, the term just annoys me because like there's no balance to me. Like if my kid's sick or in trouble, life comes first, not like I'm not balancing, if that makes sense. Like I work really hard. Thankfully, I'm blessed to have a strong resume and I've done research and, you know, learned surgery. But if my kid is sick or my wife needs me, like work doesn't come first. Life comes first. And then, you know, family comes first. And then I don't think that work ever has to take a back seat because of that. I think you can easily have your priorities in order and do both things.
Yeah. I hope every fellowship heard you say that.
I did during the interview. I don't hide from that. I think I matched where I did for residency because of that reason. I wore the same thing. I sort of, you know, said the same thing on my sleeve. And I tell them when I say that, like, I realize that could come off as I don't value my work, but look at my, you know, thank again, I don't know how to say this without sounding like a douche, but I mean, I've been able to be productive, both at work on the, you know, on the exams research wise. So clearly you can have that mentality and still do well professionally. There's no reason to think that one has to exist to the exclusion.
Oh, no. Like I'm saying that in jest because like everyone's like that, right? Or most people, sorry, any sane person is like that.
Yeah.
But it's just a lot of people hide it, you know, that's the problem.
Yeah. Well, people like
it's a good dude mentality, right?
The people in charge don't like to hear that, you know, that sometimes.
I think I thought that I thought that, but I've been really, really amazed along the entire shoulder and interview fellowship trail how much people emphasize family and the importance of family or your life outside of work if you don't have a family. Like, there's been multiple interviews where one of the interviewer's kids popped into the Zoom interview room or whatever. You know, like, it's very sort of encouraged or definitely not discouraged in any way whatsoever.
Yeah. Is it different in different subspecialties, I wonder?
No comment.
I mean, I think it is.
I don't know.
Sure, right? I mean, what's the general trauma stereotype? Right? Like, why, for example, why did I do sports and not trauma? I thought trauma was a lot of fun. That was probably one of the more fun subspecialties we did. But everyone scared me senseless because they're like, oh, you're going to be on call all the time. You're working all the time. You're not going to have a family, that this and that. Which is probably somewhat right if you're an academic center, right? I mean, you got to work and take a lot of call, but you don't have to, right? I mean, I know a lot of trauma surgeons that are in private practice just doing general ortho work who do just fine. And they don't take call at a level one trauma center or a level two trauma center. And they take whatever comes in and, you know, they can balance it too. So there's a lot of stereotypes out there about subspecialties. For even sports, right? The reason I chose sports was so I wouldn't have to take call. And I've taken call, I think, basically every day this year so far. So,
I mean, I hate the stereotype. That's absurd. Like, and that's why I say work environment, because that can be determined by your colleagues and everyone's mentality together, right? Like, if everyone agrees that, hey, we're going to value our families and our lives and our health and our mental health more than the number of hours we work in this month, that everyone can work together so that everyone is having a good, quote, work-life balance, end quote. But I think you do need the right team for that.
Well, that takes us to job searches, right? Because a lot of that depends on your partners. I'm lucky I don't have a partner, so I just get to do all the work and be mad at myself. But I know a lot of my friends who have, not so great partners who dump a lot of stuff on them, make them do a lot of cases that they don't really, that other people could really be doing. And, you know, at least a younger part of your career is not the greatest if you don't have that support system. So residency is a little different because you're all stuck there together. But when you're looking for a job, you don't have to. Here's the thing. You can't choose your co-residents in most places, right? But you can definitely choose your partners.
Yeah. And I think, again, fellowship, that's what you guys are asking, what I value is that sort of environment where it's going to be. And again, I have not found a single fellowship in shoulder that's not a positive work environment. I've been like pleasantly surprised. Like, going in, I had this mental rank list, like, oh, these are the best places or whatever. And coming out, I keep telling my wife, I'm like, I don't know how to rank these places. Like, I would be okay. You know, I'd be happy at all of them. Like, they all seem like great places to train with great attendings and great people. So I don't, shoulder's the best.
Sounds like you could do multiple years of fellowship to maximize the opportunity.
Do
them all.
If the income potential wasn't hampering, then it would be fun.
Well, you'd make like a PGY 12 salary. It'd be great.
It goes up every year, man.
PGY 52 salary.
You'd be paid just as much as a pediatrician. You'd be fine.
Oh, man. # pay the pediatricians more.
Do you care about having co-fellows, or is that?
You know, I don't really have a strong opinion either way, but then I was hanging out with some of my buddies playing basketball. Actually, these are guys that were they were like you guys. They graduated as I had started, or one of them was a 5 when I was an intern. And actually, you know Colin. I was playing basketball with Colin, and then one guy hit a year his junior, Josh Husted, who's a hand guy here, awesome guy also. And they were telling me that the co-fellows and the relationship is really, really important and a great thing to have in the future too. That they like to run things by their co-fellows or hang out with their co-fellows. So I hadn't really thought about it before this past week when I played with them and talked to them. But also in shoulder, it's so most fellowships is one fellow. Some of them are two, and maybe one or two or more than that. So it's not really that great or not that big of a consideration.
I'd agree on the co-fellows. I had two co-fellows, so 3 total. It's a lot more fun, I thought.
Yeah, I agree. I text them pretty much every day. Like, we have a text thread that we're always sharing cases and generally, you know, asking each other our thoughts on things. And yeah, we have some good, we show off our successes, and we have some bad. We're like, what would you all do with this failed, whatever it is, you know? It's definitely a nice resource to have. They both been on this podcast.
For foot and ankle or for sports, do the fellowships have like their own societies. So I think one way that Shoulder has overcome this issue is by having like alumni societies, or by having like little societies where they're sort of the alumni group together. So there's like Columbia has a really strong alumni society. And then there's one, I think it's Cleveland Clinic and Rothman and the University of Pennsylvania. All of their alumni have like a biannual meeting. So they sort of have created a system for this since the fellowships have.
There's a couple foot programs that have something like that, like the Baltimore programs do. And Duke is trying to get something started like that. We had a meeting last year that was just like an alumni meeting with a couple other programs, and we're trying to start like yearly retreats or something. But there's some programs that have it in foot.
Yeah, we didn't, but there are one, like, I think like Hawkins has his own like Hawkins Society or whatever. So all of his fellows get together to play golf like once a year or something. But we don't really have anything like that, at least at Ochsner.
Oh man, that was another thing that I don't know anything about this, but the fired up some of the gray haired old heads that we respect so much on Twitter. When so there was an article or someone posted something about Dr. Hawkins or like a biography which sort of skated over that.
I saw this.
Again, I don't know anything about this. I have no opinion on this whatsoever. But it's crazy sometimes to see the doors opening on the old political conflicts between the big games in the country.
That's a big one. That's a big one. Like the Stedman Hawkins, like,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What is it?
It's a, how the fuck?
I don't know enough about it to give you an educated description, but there was a lot of heated debate, I guess, when they changed names for Stedman Hawkins and Stedman Philippon, and then Hawkins in the Carolinas. Yeah. And then, it sounds like
it's really interesting. I have a very biased view because two of my four attendings and fellowship were Hawkins fellows. But there's a lot of it's a lot of drama, I guess is the best way to put it. When Stedman and Hawkins kind of split up or whatever you want to call it, right? There's just a lot of drama going on, a lot of money changing hands and that kind of stuff. And I don't know, I'll find the article. I'll put it up here once I find it. But
it's just interesting because, you know, we're so young. I am obviously 4 or 5 years behind you guys, but these are the names that we've learned everything from. They're the names on our textbooks, you know, and you realize that they're also regular people with regular problems.
Yeah.
At least at some point they were. And so it's just interesting to see.
But it also shows that like once you get out of fellowship and out of your first couple years of practice, which I guess we're not out of our first couple years of practice. So maybe we're a little early in this, but honestly, most of my day-to-day problems aren't anything like medicine related or surgery related. It's all like outside of, it's all like regular, I hate to say it, regular people problems, you know?
No, but that's what I was getting at. Like the most important thing is to be a good surgeon, but what I want to learn from my fellowship on top of that is how to navigate the regular people problems.
You're not going to learn that in fellowship though. I guarantee you that. The only way you can do that is through experience, and at least in my opinion.
Give an example of a regular person problem.
Well, I don't want to because then it's gonna get broadcast over. I mean, I got plenty of them, but a lot of them.
But it doesn't have to be yours. Just an example of what.
Right. So for example, like hospital administration drama, right? Which is all basically just politics. One side wants one thing, the other side hates the other side, so they, you know, do this and that. And a lot of times you'll get caught in the middle, and you don't know what side to play, right? And there's not really a right answer to it. It depends on your point of view, right? Like for me, the right answer is the one that benefits you, right? The most. I mean, it's a selfish answer, but it is what it is. That's a very vague scenario.
So basically you're referring to problems that occur in the workplace, but aren't necessarily
actual medicine itself.
Yeah. They're not patient care stuff.
What you can learn in fellowship to help you deal with that is, I guess, how to address. Maybe you can learn it a little bit. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you can learn it a little bit. At least, like, what attitude to take, how to address that kind of stuff. I mean, I guess I did learn a little bit of that. You know, like how to handle when people tell you no. That's the hard part. How do you handle when someone tells you no? You just accept it and move on, or do you put up a fight, or when do you do that? When do you just ignore it? That
yeah, I think all, especially again, there's only like 25 shoulder programs. Leadership that
you learn is exemplary, right? Because those people.
No, I can't hear you. You dropped out.
Sorry, give me one sec.
Yeah, there you go.
It's good now. Okay, so like the leadership is sort of exemplary, right? Like these people that have created shoulder and elbow departments, they didn't exist 20 years ago, and they've built fellowships that didn't exist 20 years ago. And so all of them are relatively experienced as far as leadership is concerned. And so I think you do get exposed to a lot of really high level leadership and program development and recruiting type things, because these programs are all, they're all doing that. One of the places you is hiring a third faculty. And they talked about that process, and you'll be there to see that, you know, how that works for a new faculty and things
right.
like that.
But I wouldn't consider that a problem. I wouldn't consider that like an obstacle, right? That's program development. That's, hiring.
No, you learn and you see how they overcome the problems or the obstacles or how the challenges with doing that.
So here's a better scenario, right? Like, how do you fire someone? Do you learn that in fellowship?
No, that I can't imagine. We're not in a position to do that for a long time.
But I am, though, right? Like, I've had to fire three or four people. So last podcast, I fired like three or four people. And you just have to do it, right? Like, you don't learn that. Yeah. It comes through experience, or when, like, when do you just discipline a person versus when do you escalate it and fire them, right? Like, how many chances do you give someone? If someone's a really strong worker, right? If you have like a really strong nurse. And let's just say they act out in like, you know, punch a wall or punch a computer or something. What do you do? Do you fire them away? You fire away one of your strongest nurses for a quick outbreak? Or like, you don't, if you learn that in fellowship, you wouldn't have enough time to learn anything else.
So I would argue I learned a lot of that in residency, and it's been the hardest thing I've learned in residency.
That I will say, yeah, you do. Depending on your program, you do see a lot.
Yeah, so like I've had, when you're the chief on the trauma service, you have a team, right? You have two juniors and they're your responsibility. And then you have an intern that changes every month. And that has been the most challenging thing, not because they're not amazing. Like my interns have all been great, but they're all different. And so you have to learn how to, and they're doing the probably the worst job in the residency program, you know, when you're the intern on the trauma service. And so you have to learn each of their personalities. You have to learn how to, what makes them tick or how to push them. You have to learn how to have conversations about them when they've made a mistake or when they've done something wrong without, I mean, that's been the hardest part by far. And I think it's been awesome and honestly fun to look back on it. But in the moment, it's one of the hardest things to learn and grasp and move on from.
So I will say if you have 6 years or 5 years in residency, right, you can kind of develop a lot more of that. I would argue that your year in fellowship shouldn't be about that, right? Your year in fellowship shouldn't be about how to deal with people, I guess, right? That should be something you learn either through med school and residency as you're in your 20s. But I guess you can boil a lot of the problems in our workplace down to dealing with people. How do you deal with people? That's not always something you can learn either, right? Like, some people just have better skills with that than other people do. And some jobs are not right for other people for that reason, right? I mean, like you can, if you want to, I don't know, every job has its problems. Some jobs have more problems than the others. It's an easy way to put it.
I agree. It's my positive work environment comment.
Yeah.
In my fellowship, I had like 7 attendings and 5 of them were academic type. I mean, they're all academic. They're all doing research, but 5 of them were on academic type contracts, and 2 of them were like private type contracts. And they had a lot of control over their clinic, and they had hiring and firing abilities, and they could hire PAs, extra PAs if they wanted, and fire them if they wanted. And in that 1 year, I got to see that happen. I got to see new PAs start, and I got to see PAs getting fired. But I think you're right that even though I was there and I was seeing it happen. And I had conversations with my attendings about, you know, why are you letting this one go? And, you know, how are you going to get this new one acclimated? And even though we had those conversations, I'd imagine that there's nothing like it once you get out, like what you're doing and having to make those decisions yourself. You know, so luckily I'm an academic, so I don't have to make those decisions. But, you know, even though I saw it happen and I probed my attendings about what their thought process was, I don't really think it really prepared me for you know, if I had to make that decision. There's really nothing like when you have to do it yourself. And when you do have to do it yourself, though, it is nice to have those phone numbers to call and to ask them for how they did it back in the day. So
I will say, a lot of the times, if I'm having to call someone, I know what their answer is going to be already. And especially with my fellowship guys, right? Like if I had to call them about a question, I pretty much know what they're going to say. So you do get a model of how people's certain attitudes, right? If you look at successful people in fellowship, right? Like not every attending in every fellowship is as successful as others, you know, as whether that's volume, whether that's academics, like, or, you know, administrative ladder, like, there's different ways to be successful, and some people are just different at it, but you kind of align yourself with what you want to be, I think. And that's kind of a model you follow. Now that you can't apply that to every situation, but the general attitude can kind of help guide a lot of that. If you want to reach something like your mentor, right? I don't know if that makes any sense, but it did in my head.
I think there's a couple people, you know, from fellowship that I aspire to be like, and you just model yourself after them, both consciously and subconsciously. And those are the ones I typically still keep in touch with more often than the others.
I think it's important too, like, we spent 20 minutes or whatever not talking about this. The first thing was being good at surgery. So if you're not being able to get to that point, that's what your fellowship is about the whole year. You know what I mean? Most people tell me that by year month 5 or 6, you're pretty comfortable doing cases on your own. And that's when you start thinking about these other things. But again, I think it's just, I want to emphasize that. And I mean, this, honestly, this came after I interviewed and talked to Lisa Gallitz too, who's obviously held a bunch of leadership roles at different health systems and networks. But surgery first, like, you have to be technically competent first. All of this other stuff is fun to talk about.
But right, that was my original point, right? Like, if you're spending too much time being able to do this in fellowship,
yeah,
you either had a really good residency or you're not having a very good fellowship.
Well, I mean, your residency experience is varied, right? Like, I would say I'm getting a lot of really great experience at some stuff and not at other stuff. And I'm sure everybody is like that. And so, you know, if the thing that you got a really great exposure to is also the thing you're doing your fellowship in, well, you've already done, you know, 200 of those cases. So it's,
I think that's a fair question. Why are you doing a fellowship, right? Just for connections? Like,
no, to learn some of this other stuff too.
Is it though? Well, I'm saying if you had a very, very strong residency, like, for example, if I had a very strong residency in sports, which I think both Jay and I would say that we really didn't when we were there, right? Do I need to do a sports fellowship? Could I have just gone and that opportunity cost of the 6 year, is that worth it if you don't really need to learn how to do those cases?
So I've got a buddy who absolutely does not want to do a fellowship. He hates the idea. He just wants to go out, and he doesn't really want to work in a big city. He wants to work. He wants to work in a rural environment where they don't really care if you're fellowship trained or not so much. They just want somebody to come out there and do orthopedics.
Exactly.
But he or she is still doing a fellowship because I think if you ever change your mind or you want to come work for a big health system or in a big city, they prefer fellowship trained surgeons for marketability purposes, I think. And then also the leadership of our program, and I think other programs, sort of values the fellowship and says it's important. Like arthroplasty, for example, in my residency, we do basically 6 months of arthroplasty as a 5. And most of our trauma guys also do elective arthroplasty. So you do a bunch of elective arthroplasty on all your trauma rotations. Our tumor doc does arthroplasty, so half your tumor rotation. We do a lot of arthroplasty is my point, you know?
Right.
And he's going into arthroplasty, and he's like, dude, I have done a lot of arthroplasty, a lot of revision arthroplasty, you know, he or she. And so they doesn't want to do a fellowship, but feels like the system says you have to now.
I don't know if I believe that you have to, you know. I think a lot of you can. I think for the vast majority, it's hard to ballpark it. Maybe let's say like 70% maybe of people coming out of residency for the jobs they're going to end up taking probably don't need a fellowship if you had a good training in residency, right? To be a general orthopedist, I'd say a lot of people think that they're going to subspecialize coming out of residency and end up doing a lot of general. And the reason is it's very tough to subspecialize if you're not in a big hospital system, where you have multiple, you know, orthopedic surgeons who are each specialized in their own thing. You just can't make up the volume unless you have that, you know. Nowadays you can't generate enough revenue to justify your job if you aren't doing a little bit of general, unless you're in one of those situations. So in that case, if you're, you know, for marketing, you know, as far as the marketing goes, I've seen some very shady marketing as far from different surgeons, you know, that aren't, number one, aren't fellowship trained. Number two, aren't even board certified. And number three, might not even be ABOS certified, right? They could be either through osteopathic or anything else subspecialized, but you can market anything you want, right? You can smoke and mirror your way to sound like the greatest total joint surgeon in the world and put all these patient testimonials on there. And, you know, it's a web page, right? And the sad part is most patients aren't going to notice. They're not going to know the difference. So do you really need it for marketing? Probably not. Are you really going to need it for your job? I don't think so for most people. And you're sacrificing, you know, let's say on average, what, $400,000, $500,000 for your first year. And that's in that PGY 6 year for a fellowship that you might not need. I think we put a lot of emphasis on fellowships when we maybe don't need to. And it's not the right answer for everyone.
Yeah, I think it's just too variable to make blanket statements. Because again, some residencies, hey, you get a great training in surgery A, but not surgery B, and things like that. So I think, like for me, I would love to do a fellowship. I think there's a lot of things, especially on the far fringes of the shoulder world, things like tendon transfers and things like that, that nobody gets a high volume of in residency. Right, right. Not a lot of people do that.
I agree with that. If that's the kind of stuff you want to do in practice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think it all depends what kind of career you envision yourself having. I mean, I'm an academic, so pretty much every new hire we have in our department is subspecialized. So I see guys like, you know, my partner, like myself, and, you know, Dr. Lindemann and Weiss, and all these new hires in the last few years, they all come into the department and they're given a role. You know, Lindemann's a sports guy, I'm the foot guy. Sure, we do some general trauma when we're on call. But we wouldn't be able to have these jobs probably not as easily if we didn't have a subspecialty.
Right, not in an academic center.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. It's what you envision it. If you want to go to a rural place where, you know, you have to do a lot of general and there's not a lot of subspecialists around, then there's no need to get that subspecialty training to set yourself apart, because you're pretty much one of the few guys in town. And so it all depends what you want to do with it.
I think we downplay the cost of it a lot, though. You know, if you are going to do a fellowship, you need to realize that that's you're basically costing yourself $400,000. Let's say $400,000 to do that fellowship, right?
It's actually probably a lot more than that over 40 years, but yeah.
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 Would you go back and do your fellowship? Oh, I mean, I know you would. I would too. Yeah.
I'm going to say alternative. We'll go back. Universally, everyone I've ever met, literally everyone, yeah, which is a rare thing to say, says their fellowship year is the best year of their career.
Yeah, nobody regrets doing their fellowship. Actually, no, that's not true. I think one of my co-fellows would probably say he regretted doing his fellowship, but mostly for that opportunity cost. He's like, he's the situation I talked about, right? He's in private practice in a pretty competitive market in Florida. And he's like, look, I do maybe 20% sports cases and everything else is just general ortho, joints, fracture work, like all this stuff, because that's how I make my money. I don't have an elective sports practice here because it's a very competitive market. I didn't need to do a fellowship. Like I wasted whatever dollar amount you want to say for that year when I could have just been making that money before. So I don't think he's the only one, but I agree. Most people, I mean, everyone on this, all two of us who have done fellowships, would still do their fellowship. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe that negates my whole argument.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're thinking about it purely from a financial standpoint and your goal is to maximize the money you make, then don't do a fellowship. Go somewhere that you don't need a fellowship and, you know, work your butt off for, you know, a couple of years or a lot of, you know, whatever it is, and make a ton of money. And definitely the fellowship opportunity cost is going to decrease how much you make over the long term. But if you want to choose the city you live in, and if you want to be able to have a job in no matter how competitive of an environment, and if you want to keep all your options open, academics, teaching, or private, or whatever it is, then fellowship gives you as
much. I'll push back a little bit on that part. Right. Just having a fellowship doesn't mean you can work in any city you want, right?
Right, but it gives you. It's all about. It's easier than not. So if you want to, if you want to back into a competitive market, it's easier than not to have that fellowship. So it doesn't open up every door in the world, but it gives you more keys than if you didn't have a fellowship, I'd say.
So, I think because there's so many people who have fellowships now, you stand out if you don't. So if you're going to be in a bigger area, then yeah, you should probably have something on that resume so you don't stand out, right?
Right.
But two, because there's so many people who have fellowships, the supply and demand is very tilted, right? So a lot of it still depends on job openings and this and that. Like people aren't gonna come knocking down doors to come hire a sports fellow,
right? Right.
You know, and it doesn't matter what city it's in, but it does help. I guess you said it's you're more likely to get a job with the fellowship than you are without. I think it's safe to say, right?
Right, and I'll say here too. I mean, I've had patients come to me. Yeah, I've had this happen where a patient comes into the hospital and one of my partners is on call who's not fellowship trained. And instead of following up with that surgeon for the definitive surgery, they show up to my clinic purely because they looked me up and saw that I had a fellowship subspecialty in ankle trauma. So, or ankles in general, but you know, ankle fractures and stuff. So, you know, I have had patients come to me purely because of that subspecialty background.
The real kicker nowadays is the people that are doing too. I'm like, please stop doing that because I don't want that to be normal. Oh, there's a lot of people that are doing two fellowships. I've met at least three or four people on the shoulder interview trail that are current fellows and something else that are interviewing for further. And they've matched for a fellowship. Most people that are at least in this, well, I've seen sports shoulder, hand shoulder, and trauma shoulder.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, shoulder's a bit of a niche thing, so I sort of understand that, but at the same time, that sets a precedent that gets worse and worse, and not worse, but that gets more and more challenging, not less and less.
So the hot one in the sports world now is doing a sports fellowship and then doing hip preservation.
Yeah.
Kind of a newly made up kind of thing, I guess, over the last maybe 5-10 years, I think.
Yeah.
Man, that's a niche, right? Like you'll find an academic job with that specialty, but
I know multiple people. Our number one sports shoulder guy 20 or 30 years ago came into the city as the hip scope guy because that's what the practice he wanted to join needed. He hasn't spoken the hip in a decade, but that's what he started off being, the hip scope guy.
That's crazy.
Yeah, just to get the job.
Yeah, two fellowships, that's a ton, man. That's,
you see it a lot in PD, like PD spine and PD sports.
Yeah,
PD sports. You see that a lot. I think that kind of makes sense to some degree because pediatrics is, I mean, sometimes we joke about, you know, pediatric ortho surgeons, but they have to learn a lot in that one fellowship year because they have to do PD spine, they have to do the sports part, they have to do the trauma part, the deformity part, the congenital stuff. Like that.
Yeah, I mean, you get – residency is 5 years. It's 4 years and 6 months of adult surgery and 6 months
right,
of
surgery. Exactly. And the pediatric conditions oftentimes are way different than the adult conditions. Like for the most part, I don't touch pediatric foot deformities if I can avoid it, because that's not what I did in my fellowship. So, or in my residency for that matter.
And it makes sense if that's what you want to do and you're gonna end up in an academic place where you're gonna see enough volume of that to justify, you know, your practice. And that's what you got to do, right? I mean, that's how you get hired in those jobs. But it's like you said, you got to make sure that's what you want to do before you commit 2 years of your life to, especially 2 years of your prime earning years to just fellowships, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think in terms of choosing a fellowship, you know, Midhat, I think my thoughts are like you said, in general, you know, 99% or 95% of fellowships are all really good, but they're all different. And the most important thing, you know, when I tell residents who are thinking about fellowship, I tell them the most important thing is to define what you want to get out of the fellowship. Like, do you want a fellowship that's a springboard into academic, or do you want a fellowship that will prepare you for, you know, high volume community practice? just kind of know what you're good, what you want out of it, and that'll help you narrow your decision making, your rank list.
Not every fellowship is a good fellowship for everyone.
Right, exactly. There's better, you know, for me, you know, Duke was really good for me because they're academic, but they also have, you know, so when people think academic, I think there may be a thought that the surgical volume or the hands-on experience isn't as good, but Duke isn't that case because I was doing cases from day one pretty much autonomously, or not autonomously, I was supervised, but they were letting me do the whole case. So halfway through my fellowship year, you know, I was comfortable enough to start teaching the residents how to do the cases. And that was a really good springboard into my current job, which basically is doing the same thing. But if you're trying to go into private practice and just be as efficient as possible and do as many cases in an efficient manner with low cost, it might not be the best fellowship for you. So,
and that's also very hard to gauge because you don't know, sometimes you don't know what you're going to need out of fellowship. You know, like if I could go back to fellowship, I think my outlook would be completely different with the job I have now than it was when I went in. Right. You can't predict the future, what kind of job you're going to have or how the market's going to shake out. So, even if you go in with that sentiment, don't ignore the other parts of it, because at some point in your life, you'll probably need all of it. And there's parts of fellowship I wish I paid more attention to than, you know, the parts that I thought I needed to pay attention to. You can shoehorn yourself into like one role, but keep it open.
Yeah.
How stressful is the process compared to applying to residency?
Oh, it's a whole world. It's not even the same process. I mean, it's stressful to have a match, but like the fellowship match is more like, hey, we'd love to have you here. This is what we have to offer, et cetera, et cetera. The residency match is more like, please, will you take me, please? You know, it's way different. And then when I say there's more, you know, there are more shoulder applicants than there are shoulder spots. So people will go and match this year, although that's not typical every year. You know, in residency, there's almost two applicants per spot now. So that's a whole different level of competitive. My advice to most residents nowadays is literally don't worry about where you're trying to go to residency. Just try to get a residency spot versus fellowship, where you do have a lot. I think, I mean, maybe we'll have a match and I'm going to fall to the last thing on my rank list and I'll be, I'll be surprised, I guess. But I think there's a lot more flexibility in fellowship, and that there is a lot more people are able to find what's good for them, and the fellowships are able to find the fellows that are good for them. Whereas in residency, it's less so in that regard. Also, everyone knows each other fellowship trail-wise. For the most part, people know each other. Residency, I mean, there's 1,000 applicants. People don't know anybody.
Yeah, those, I don't know, are you guys still having like those awkward interview socials on Zoom?
For fellowships?
Yeah.
Not really. I mean, they're not really socials, I guess. They're sort of driven information session type things. So you're not really just sitting there chatting with strangers in a room, but... We did for residency. It was painful.
No, did you enjoy the interview trail and fellowship, like traveling to cities and kind of having that experience?
I hit my wallet.
Yeah.
I would have had to narrow down who I was interviewing.
Are you more of like a DeMar DeRozan guy or like a James Harden guy at this point?
Me?
Yeah.
I hate James Harden. So absolutely can't stand the guy.
Good how there's a bird behind you.
Yeah, this is my yard. It's really nice. Credit to my wife. She's a big yard gardening person. Obviously,
that's really nice, man.
Yeah. There's toys and stuff scattered everywhere because my children are animals, but you know.
Do you guys think in the future they should go back to in-person interviews for fellowship, or is the Zoom thing going to stay? Should stay?
I think they should go back. I don't think they should for residency because I think it's. I mean, financially, it's hard for fellows, but at least we have an income and a choice. I mean, for med students, you're just taking on an extra $10,000 in low interest debt for 20 years to be able to go on those interviews for the most part. But for fellows, I mean. Maybe you're doing that, maybe you're not, but at least there's some flexibility or freedom to choose that. Also in residency, you know, when you're applying to residency, you'll offer
probably. Why does it keep doing this?
Sorry. In residency, you'll probably take every interview you get and try to go on all of them, you know, whereas in fellowship, you don't necessarily have to do that if you're, you know, depending on your situation or where you're interviewing or what, you know, you're.
Yeah. I did an interview like 2 days before once. Because I was at another interview and everyone said that the program wasn't very good. Like, I was like, well, I could, stay another couple days in Chicago or I could go on this interview. I'm like, sorry, I can't make it, guys.
Was that for fellowship or residency?
Huh?
Was that for fellowship or residency?
That was fellowship. Yeah, no way I would do that in residency. You can't,
that's what I'm saying. So, you know,
yeah, I crawl to an interview for residency.
Yeah. I drove. Like, I made this like weird circuitous drive from Dallas to Oklahoma City to Columbia, Missouri, back down through another city, back down to Dallas.
I had a conflicting interview when I applied for residency. Two programs I had on the same day, and it was the only day, and I had to choose one. And I was like pretty stressed out about it at the time. I'm like, oh man, why can't I just take both? And it was going to decrease my chances 0.5% of matching.
I had the same thing, and then I didn't match it either. So
I had the same thing, and it was between JPS and UTMB.
Look at the choice you made, man. I don't know why you would make that choice, but look at yourself now.
No, it was because I had already committed to UTMB, and JPS was like a last minute off the wait list kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, sorry.
You thought your chances were better.
Yeah. No, I just didn't want to, I don't know. I don't want
to. I have strong feelings about those programs, so no comment.
All right. UTMB is a place to be.
You're already there.
Excellent institution. I gotta get a job first. Once I have a job, then I can let my true opinions out. I'm just kidding. I like UTMB. I think UTMB is a wonderful place to train, especially. You can't get distracted because there's nothing to be distracted by. So,
jeez. Man, I'm here. It's a good thing.
Dude, all we did was study and play basketball, which was awesome. I mean,
yeah.
And I got in residency, yeah. And I know stuff, you know? So clearly someone taught me something. No, I like the UTMB a lot.
When are your rank lists due?
I don't know. Really? In 3 weeks.
How far into the interview process are you? Like,
I've got like three left.
Three left?
Yeah, three or four left. But we got some heavy hitters left. Mayo Clinic's next week. Rothman's in 2 weeks. And then some place said multiple interview dates. So I keep saying that, and I don't know who's left for, you know what I mean? I don't know. The place I've already interviewed might have more interview dates, but I don't know. I don't know those ones. So
are you more of like a Giannis guy or like a Embiid guy?
Oh, that's tough. I mean, I love watching Embiid, but I respect Giannis.
Giannis or DeMar DeRozan?
Giannis. Dude, Giannis grew up on the street selling trinkets. Like, now he makes $52 million a year, and he's like the Mamba mentality guy. Like, he's the one who wants to win the All-Star. He's the only competitive player at the All-Star game. Like, he's like, I got to win everything no matter what.
Would you rather have like a mayo sandwich or like a Philly cheesesteak?
Mayo sandwich. A Philly cheesesteak is a sandwich with steak and mayonnaise, isn't it?
No.
I'm a Luka Doncic guy. That's what I am. And Steph Curry, of course, because I play basketball like Steph Curry so that I don't get hurt. So, as you all know, once you cross half court, anything's free. Anything's free game.
That's what I tell myself, too, but it doesn't work.
Do you guys still play at all?
I like shoot around once in a while. I don't really play games anymore. I actually started, in addition to boxing, which I've done a few times now, once in a while, I'll play like soccer games with like my kids' teams, and like it's kind of fun. It's a huge field and it's good exercise.
I think honestly, soccer might be more fun than basketball because you can just run around and have a good time. But
I try to make it out. So last time I played was like I think last weekend, and if I've been playing, it's been maybe once or twice a week or once every other week at times, just because the schedule's been so busy recently.
Yeah,
the last time I went out like. It was great. I played like my standard hour and a half, 2 hours. And then my team kept winning. One guy, who was, I found out he's like a top 30 recruit nationally. and I could play it another 3 hours. So I didn't do anything. Like I would just get the ball and pass it to him, and then just kind of up and down the court, and got a little more cardio. And it was
That's great.
Yeah,
I find it
for me. There's not a good place to play. Like, so I have a membership at the LA Fitness, and it's pretty cheap membership, and it's close to where I live. The pickup basketball is such trash. Like, just the style. Yeah. It's not that the players are bad. They're good players. It's just the style of play is such garbage that I don't like playing those games. It's
tough. Oh, dude. LA Fitness is the baller's life crew, as I call it.
Yeah.
It's tough to find, people, like, good games in your 30s, you know? Because the high school kids all play it like a certain way, and you hate playing.
Yeah.
So if I'm playing with them, it's just getting cardio in, right? If you start playing with the older guys, you're like, you're still a little too young for them, so it's almost too easy. But unless you're playing with like people in your age group, it sucks.
Yeah, there's this group of attendings out here. They rent out a high school gym one night a week for an hour and a half, and they're all like young attendings. They won't put me in the group chat because I'm still a resident, but when they need a body, they always text me. And so almost every week, it's really actually very nice. I don't know how I found them or how they found each other, but it's like my favorite.
Yeah, see, that's what you need. You need people who know each other enough to not hurt each other.
Yeah.
And who are right around the same age group as you, so that, one, you're also not going to hurt each other. You just don't want to get hurt.
Same injuries.
You just don't want to get hurt. Speaking of resident wellness and getting hurt and athletic stuff, we're organizing a striker rep versus UTMB ortho fly football game.
You guys are going to get annihilated. You're going to get annihilated. You're going to get
Striker notoriously has the most jacked reps ever.
Dude, they're all former college athletes.
Yeah, a lot of them were college linemen.
Yeah, they're former college athletes.
But here's my thought is that they're linemen. It's fly football, so there's not really a line. You know, you have a quarterback and you have like six receivers.
If you made it out of there with an Achilles, that's intact.
Right.
I would not take on the reps. Don't tell that to Luke and Trent. I could take Luke and Trent. Those are our striker reps. But
I don't know. Bill Weiss said he used to be quarterback.
Can you pick like a different company? Like,
I know.
Or like Wright Medical.
Or like, you know, something weird like Acumed or Exact Tech. Like,
yeah. Exogen or whatever.
You had to pick Striker. Striker's going to buy like current NFL players to fly in. Guys.
No, I love the Striker reps. I like all the reps. There's no bias against any of those. We just use Striker for everything.
That was a paid, non-paid advertisement.
No, I like you guys mentioned email earlier. I put in one Cindy's nail in residency, and that's it. Otherwise, we've only, you know, between the private group we work with and the hospital system, they're all contracted to Striker, so we use Striker. That's just how it is. Which I also think is something to learn in fellowship, if possible, is different systems and different implant companies and stuff, because it's easy to end up biased just by your training versus what's actually good, not good.
I had it too. Huge bias from what you use in training.
Yeah.
All right. Let's wrap it up.
You guys already know my favorite bone is the scapula, so it's the best bone in the body.
Yeah.
Objectively.
I have a new favorite bone.
I don't know. I still haven't decided.
Scope it. You can do things open.
My favorite bone is the one I'm fixing.
Ooh, okay. My favorite patient is the one I'm operating on right now.
Yeah. My favorite institution is
the one I'm
looking at. All right. See you guys next time.
All right. See you guys.
Yeah.